Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Chapter 51. King City. Rose and Jason. Rose's heart pounded in her chest as she realized how close to being shot she had been moments ago. She and Jason had jogged through the warehouse complex and stopped when they reached the street. Jason gripped the pistol he took, and Rose was holding the gun Jason seized after disarming Mac.
"I almost got killed," she said,
breathing heavily before turning to Jason.
"What happened back there? How did you find me? How did Mac have a gun? Why did you have a gun?"
Her confused tone sounded accusatory. He backed away a few paces.
"After we spoke, I went into the bathroom to freshen up when I heard gunfire,"
Jason said.
"I left the bathroom, the two guards were killed, and I was terrified. Armed people clearly had stormed the club, so I figured you—"
He furrowed his brow.
"You and others might still be in the club."
He inhaled. Rose looked at him, her eyes softening.
"I took a gun from one of the dead guards and followed the sounds to your room. You know the rest."
Rose's eyes widened.
"You didn't see Easton, did you?"
"No, I didn't see anyone else."
"He could be in trouble. We have to go back."
She turned around and started walking back toward the club, but Jason jumped in front of her, holding his arms up.
"It's too dangerous, Rose. It must have been a gang of people who murdered the club security. With machine guns. If the train security guards were killed, we wouldn't survive. I'm not a soldier. I'm just a lawyer. I want to help Easton, but running back in right now is a death wish."
Rose thought for a moment, trying to formulate a plan.
"All right,"
Rose said, trying to calm herself.
"Let's try and make it on foot to my house. I live in Clinton Hill near Fort Greene. It's only 3 or 4 miles. We should try to catch an AI taxi or a cab on the way. Once we get there, we'll figure out how to help Easton."
"I don't have my UD,"
Jason said.
"I can't call an AI taxi."
"Damn it,"
she exclaimed in a hushed voice.
"I left my UD in the club. I can't call an AI taxi either."
Rose had been squeezing the diamond instinctively as they spoke, and its hard edges had imprinted deep lines into her palms.
"We really need to get out of here,"
Jason declared.
"My UD is at my condo in Manhattan."
"Let's start by going to my house. It's closer. Maybe we can contact him using the song program LD's message platform."
"Okay, but we should avoid main roads,"
Jason suggested, winded from running across the parking lot.
"Let's flag down the police."
"Lots of cops in the NYPD know and hate me. If they find out that I was present at the club, they'll try and pin it on me."
"Why?"
"I can explain another time. Plus, you're in a cocktail dress. I'm in a suit. We stick out. If Mac leaves the club in a car to come after us, he'll know what to look for."
"Fine, but what should I do with this?"
Rose held up the gun.
"I have nowhere to put it."
"I can carry it,"
Jason offered.
"Okay,"
Rose said, handing the gun to Jason, who stuffed it into the lining breast pocket of his suit. Rose led the way and Jason followed. For 20 minutes, the only sound was their breathing as they ran, zigzagging through deep Brooklyn, jogging across footbridges over train tracks, weaving through ramshackle and empty industrial complexes. Scrawled graffiti seemed to follow them as they ran, covering building facades and old parked trucks and vans. A plastic grocery bag floated past them on the crisp air like an urban tumbleweed. The pair had continued jogging past Bushwick Avenue, through Sternberg Park, and across Union Avenue into Williamsburg. Although a borough of the greater New York metropolis, Brooklyn was its own city with an amalgamation of cultures coexisting, in a stark contrast to the dimly lit, dead-looking warehouses in the industrial side streets of Bushwick. The main thoroughfares of Brooklyn bustled with cars, eye taxis, and people. Its residents were a mixed composition of black, brown, and white. Latino men sipped Modelo beers outside of Mercados. Hasidic Jews strolled home in packs from Shabbat celebrations. A shopkeeper watched an Arabic soap opera on a tube television. Men and women in colorful kente cloth laughed as they kicked a soccer ball with their children. Notwithstanding the many differences, technology seemed to be the common thread weaving all these different types of people together. Every single person held a UD in his or hand. As Rose and Jason walked in silence, marveling at the mingling cultures and people in Brooklyn, they momentarily forgot that they were on the run. After crossing Broadway, they found a street vendor selling cheap electronic knockoffs, purses, scarves, and filtered cloth masks. Jason stopped.
"We should buy masks. They'll make it more difficult for people to identify us,"
he said, with a tone of urgency.
"Don't these vendors only take paper and payment apps?"
Rose asked. She had not interacted with a street vendor in years. Almost all day-to-day transactions, in her experience, happened with credit cards loaded on UDs, cryptocurrency, Visi scans, or UD payment apps. Jason turned to the vendor and asked for two black filtered cloth masks as he stuffed his hand into the inner pocket of his jacket, extracting a $20 bill folded into a small rectangle.
"You carry paper?"
Rose said with widening eyes as Jason unfurled the sturdy cotton paper and handed it to the vendor.
"I haven't seen physical cash in like a decade."
"My dad always taught me to keep cash on hand for emergencies. My partner Anton used to make fun of me for it,"
Jason said as he handed Rose the mask. She put the stretchy fabric loops over the backs of her ears, and Jason followed suit. They wove through smaller neighborhood streets until they reached Rose's house. The small buds on the trees lining the quiet street gave the appearance of a misty green haze over their branches in the pale eggshell light of the tall street lamps. They climbed the stone front stairs to her ornately carved wooden door with the shiny black square security pad on it.
"Damn,"
she exclaimed in a loud whisper.
"I usually open the door with my UD. Give me a sec."
She tapped the surface of the security device. A keypad with numbers, letters, and symbols appeared.
"I think the code is,"
Rose said to herself slowly as she hit a series of buttons. Each time she touched a button, a small tone issued from the pad. After several attempts, the device gave an affirmative-sounding chirp, and Rose pushed the door inward. They walked across the patterned tiles in the vestibule into the living room of Rose's home.
"This is beautiful,"
Jason said, looking around.
"Thanks,"
Rose said. Her body felt cold from the chilly spring night air. Her cocktail dress had no sleeves, and she could feel the goosebumps on her arms and shoulders.
"I'm going to change into something else and grab some things, but we need a UD to get in touch with Easton. Make sure he's safe."
She ran up the stairs.
"Do you have your song program LD?"
he asked loudly.
"We can use it to call."
"It should be on the kitchen counter,"
Rose yelled down to Jason. He scampered to the kitchen and found the song program LD sitting dark and flat like a shiny black shingle against the crystalline glint of the quartz counter. He held the LD in one hand and tapped the screen with the other. As Jason tried to access the LD, he realized that he had been on automatic pilot, letting his instincts take over since the shooting aftermath he witnessed at the club. Just a few months ago, he had dreamt of a woman dead or dying on a divan that he was certain was a figment of his imagination. It turned out she was not only real, but just less than an hour before, he had prevented her death in a scene he had foreseen. Upstairs, Rose shimmied out of her wrinkled cocktail dress and into a dark pair of jeans and a t-shirt. She found a navy vert goose full zip jacket and pulled each arm through the sleeves before rushing down the stairs back to Jason, who held the LD in different positions in front of his face, concentrating.
"What's up with this thing?"
"What?"
Rose asked as she approached him.
"LD won't turn on."
"It won't turn on?"
Rose leaned in closer to see the screen.
"No, it doesn't seem to work,"
said Jason.
"Usually when I hold it up and touch the screen, the user interface and dashboard pop up."
"Here, let me see."
Rose reached for the LD.
"Probably just the facial recognition security protocol. It's got to take a biometric read of my face."
She turned the device until she was looking into its smooth, igneous-like surface. Suddenly, white letters against the black background of the LD flashed onto the screen.
"All Pyramid Club events are temporarily suspended, and access to the song program is disabled."
"I don't understand,"
said Rose.
"I've never seen it malfunction like this."
"Maybe it's a suspension of function out of a concern for safety."
The gravity of the night's events set in for Rose just then. She realized that Mac had threatened her with a gun, and that she had just given her gun to Jason, a man that she didn't know.
"This guy saved my life. He is helping me,"
she thought. But then the fear and anxiety bubbled to the front of her mind.
"I was held at gunpoint. I could have been shot. How did that happen?"
Her heart pounded, increasing its cadence as she started inhaling and exhaling in quick succession. Noticing Rose's anxiety, Jason stood up and put his hand on her shoulder, tilting his head as he looked at her.
"Are you all right?"
She quaked almost imperceptibly.
"I'm scared for Easton,"
she said, voice low.
"I don't have anybody else. I wish I knew he was safe. Without my UD and with the song program not working, I feel powerless, alone."
"Let's get to my condo. My UD is there," Jason suggested. "From there, we can make sure Easton is okay and call the police, plan our next steps."
When their eyes met, it was as if a bolt of lightning shot from his eyes to hers, from hers to his. Their connection imbued Rose with trust in this man that she barely knew, and she could feel the tacit trust he had for her. Inhaling, Rose said,
"All right, let's do this."
Jason nodded.
"I think the safest mode of transportation is the subway. It would be hard for Mac, or whoever else, to find us that way."
"Okay, but what do we do with these guns?"
Jason pulled the two guns out of his suit and placed them on Rose's counter next to each other.
"I've had a few clients sent to prison for carrying guns into the subway. The city uses AI-powered weapon scanners in the turnstiles. I have a gun at my condo in a safe, so we have a weapon if we need it once we reach my place. We should wash our prints off these guns, wrap them in towels, and ditch them in a public trash bin. I can do it, but it would be best if you have some disposable sunglasses and a hoodie you'd be okay with getting rid of. That way, if there are city cameras near whatever bin I throw them into, they won't be able to identify me. I don't want to be on the lam for any murders traceable to these weapons."
"There are washcloths underneath the sink. Use those. I'll grab you a hoodie and cheap sunnies. I'll also grab some of my paper wallets, just in case,"
said Rose, referring to digital asset account information needed to access her cryptocurrency funds written on paper. She ran up the stairs to her room. The safe in Rose's closet opened with a tap of her thumb on the fingerprint scanner. She removed a folded-up piece of paper with long strings of digits and letters representing the private keys and addresses for several of her cryptocurrency wallets. The codes would give her access to her cryptocurrency accounts on any computer or device with interwebs or Web5 decentralized app platform access. She grabbed a shoulder bag, shoved the paper into it, and slung it across her shoulder. Jason put on latex gloves to wash the guns. He scrubbed them with dish soap, trying to hit every surface and small metal part of each gun. He put each gun in its own washcloth, wrapped each gently, and placed them in the plastic grocery bag. Rose descended with a hoodie and bright magenta-rimmed sunglasses.
"Here,"
Rose said as she passed them to Jason.
"I'll bring the LD just in case."
Rose grabbed the LD and shoved it into her shoulder bag.
"What's the nearest subway station that goes to Manhattan?"
asked Jason.
"I haven't used the subway in a while, but I think we need to take the A or the C,"
she said.
"There's a station with A and C trains on my street where it intersects with Fulton a few blocks south of here."
"When we leave, go straight to that station. I'm going to dispose of this stuff. If there are cameras around, it would be better if I went solo. I'll take a short detour."
"I'm ready."
"I'll meet you at the station in just a few minutes."
He had the hoodie bunched up under his arm and a knotted plastic bag hanging from his wrist. With his free hand, he gave Rose a $5 bill, which felt strange in her hand. She was not even sure the subway kiosks would accept it for a Metro card.
"Just get to the Manhattan-bound A or C platform and I'll meet you there."
"Okay,"
Rose said, suddenly feeling jittery. She could not discern her own emotional state. Was she afraid Jason would abandon her? Did she fear that he would return and hurt her? Would she be attacked while she waited for his arrival? The permutations of horrific futures sizzled in her mind's eye.
See you in a minute.
Chapter 52, Sane. Mac. the Lincoln Navigator EV hurtled down the main thoroughfares of Bushwick into the southern border of Williamsburg. Max sat in the back with Esri as Ballard drove with Mazzy in the passenger's seat. They were headed to Rose's house on Clinton Avenue in Fort Greene, usually a 15 or 20 minute drive away from the Pyramid Club, though at the speed they were traveling, they would arrive in 10. His blood pumping and mind abruptly jumping between thoughts, Mac tried to disregard the image of Easton's blood and flesh smeared all over the room like a grotesque modern art exhibit. Fear of Ezri's brutality was now guiding his behavior. He could not simply escape, run away, or hide. He had to fulfill his end of the constantly evolving agreement with Esri. He wanted out of Esri's employ, and the only way he saw that happening was obtaining the diamond for her. It seemed that death, or worse, was the alternative. Moreover, he began to perceive the guilt and shame of his involvement in Easton's torture, lies to his father, and betrayal of the club as a palpable sensation on his body in addition to weight on his soul. It felt like a pressure constricting his ribs, stomach, and lungs. Even if he could stir the motivation to mitigate his past harms, he knew fighting back against the calamitous force of Esri was futile, like holding back a wave with a net.
So, your lawyer, Jason Sola, helped Rose escape with my diamond. It's funny to me that he's now involved in all this. Tell me about him,
Esri demanded. When he turned to look at her, he realized she was staring at a slate device resting on her thighs, clicking, tapping, and swiping the screen. A dongle protruded from the bottom of the device, coiling like a snake, with Rose's UD at its end instead of a rattle. Esri seemed to be hacking it. Absent-mindedly, Mac jumped into describing his first interactions with Jason.
When I caught the gun charge, my dad hired him to represent me, and he...
I know all that,
Esri spat.
I know that he represented Tobias Blackburn in the Darden murder case. I know everything about the Darden murder and the case.
Esri smirked as she stared at Mac.
I also know his fucking partner's brains were blown out by cops.
She made a gesture resembling a gun with her fingers and put it to her head. Then she aggressively pointed her finger gun at Mac, who flinched again.
Give me details that will help us track them down while I try to crack this UD. What does he look like? Where does he stay? Who are his close associates?
I know where his law office is,
Mac offered.
That's a start,
Esri said. She began to tap, swipe, and type on the surface of the device, and somehow it seemed different than what she was doing a moment ago, although Mac could not see what it was. She then turned the device toward Mac so he could see the screen. Jason's professional portrait on his website was framed perfectly inside the device. In his grayscale picture, he stood in a suit and tie, arms crossed, jawline pronounced, corners of his mouth turned upwards slightly. He stood before a wall with legal tomes stacked neatly on shelves and next to a window with a view of downtown Manhattan.
That's him,
Mac said. Esri turned back, facing forward, staring at the screen.
I recognize him.
You do?
Mac asked.
It's all coming back to me now. I ran into him at Disco Ardent once briefly, but I never forget the face of a person that I think about potentially maiming.
Her pointy smile made Mac squirm with discomfort when she looked at him.
It's time to use your powers of deduction, no matter how dull they may be. Why is that helpful for us?
Mac thought back to his most recent visit to Disco Ardent.
It was in a warehouse, long lines. A bouncer waved a wand over my UD as I entered.
The realization struck Mac like an open-palmed slap.
When you scanned his UD, you infected it with something.
Bravo!
Esri exclaimed, applauding with histrionic slow claps.
You're catching on, but it's even better than that. Now I don't have to try to social engineer a scheme to get him to install my malware tracker on his UD, because I already did all that when he came to my club.
The scenes outside the car streaked by as they barreled down Flushing Avenue, which bustled with bikes, cars, vendors, and pedestrians. A jaywalking man dodged out of the Navigator's path, throwing his arms up angrily as it sped past him. A cyclist sharing the lane swerved in front of the Navigator, and without slowing, Ballard aggressively pounded the horn, speeding past the cyclist who swerved out of the lane, almost crashing into a parked car. As Mac watched the storefronts and sidewalks whiz by, the image of Easton's broken body filled his mind. He closed his eyes and shook his head, but the image did not fade. The Navigator careened onto Rose's street and screeched to a halt in front of her address. Ezri's minions disembarked from the navigator, charging toward Rose's row house, which looked empty from the outside. They marched up the stoop stairs to the front door and stood quietly, pistols drawn, as Ezri removed a UD from her satchel. By yanking it from her bag, Ezri had awakened the device, so the screen illuminated, showing the cheerful love photo of Easton and Rose.
"I made quick work of her UD's security," she said,
as she held Rose's UD up to the security pad on the wooden doorframe. The security pad responded with an affirmative chirp, and the locking mechanism seemed to audibly disengage in response. Mac hung back as Mazzy kicked the door open with a whack and entered the house, followed by Ballard and Ezri, who pulled her Uzi from the satchel. The four strode through the small vestibule into the dimly lit house. Mazzy hit the light switch on the wall past the front vestibule, flooding the area with a warm and welcoming light.
"Mazzy and Mac, upstairs. Ballard down,"
Ezri commanded in a forceful whisper. Mac ascended behind Mazzy, looking around. They turned into the first room off the stairs, and Mac noticed a dress discarded in a heap on the ground next to a bed. It appeared to be the same one Rose wore during that night's performance. He saw no sign of the diamond.
"Clear,"
a deep voice declared. Mac realized he had never heard Mazzy nor Ballard utter a single word. A second muffled, "clear," came from below. As he walked down the stairs, Mac could see Ezri pacing in the kitchen, Mazzy and Ballard seemingly standing by.
"The diamond?"
Ezri asked, not looking at Mac.
"Nothing,"
Mac replied as he reached the bottom.
"A dress that looked a lot like the one she wore tonight was on her floor. Looks like she may have come here and changed."
Ezri looked up.
"I want that diamond,"
she said quietly. She lifted the gun and pointed it at him as if she were merely pointing her finger, bore her teeth, and screamed in his face.
"I want that diamond!"
All three men in the room recoiled at her outburst, the gun bobbing and moving with her gesticulations.
"Get me that fucking diamond!"
Mac lifted his hands up.
"I will, I will."
Her voice returned to a normal volume.
"You better,"
she said, walking up to Mac, looking up at him and pushing her chest against his belly. She jabbed the Uzi into the soft flesh under his chin so the tip of the barrel pushed his face upward.
"You're going to track Jason and Rose down. I suggest you leverage some of your relationships, like the one with your father, for instance, while I remotely access Jason's UD and use it to track him."
"I will."
She dropped the gun from under Mac's chin. Ezri smiled.
"That's a good boy."
She turned and walked away from him.
"I'm going to dispose of our late friend Easton and make sure everything at the club is cleaned up and untraceable to us. I'll also try and tap into the club's servers with some special hardware. When I'm done, I'll leave a couple surveillance goodies there in case they go back to check on Easton. Then I'll start squeezing the people in the immediate circles of Jason and Rose so they'll have no one to turn to."
She continued to walk away from Mac.
"I'll send you information of their whereabouts as soon as I know."
Chapter 53. Promise. Rose and Jason. The acrid smell of damp trash hung in the air as Rose waited for Jason on the platform. Puddles of waterlogged paper, plastic containers, and shrink wrapping filled the gaps between the tracks. Hardened dirt and grime, mashed into the concrete walls, seemed to dull the bright lights of the station. Thick plastic panels, scratched, gouged, and graffitied from transparency into translucence, covered framed ad posters on the walls. Water dripped from the ceiling into a puddle in the corner of the platform as Rose ruminated on the night's events.
"I hope Easton is okay."
She imagined the possibility of Easton being harmed, or worse, killed. It made her feel hollow. Like her guts had been scooped out and alone, like a thirsty wanderer in a desert salt flat, no life in sight. She tapped her fingers together and paced over a few feet of the dingy tiles on the floor. The station's gloom, silence, and late-night emptiness heightened her anxiety. Apprehensive that Mac or someone else could appear out of the shadows and accost her, Rose's eyes flicked from one side of the platform to the other, scanning for potential assailants. Tomas and Jana had been murdered. Her mind generated images of the dead security guards.
But for what reason? What was the motive? Mac had money. Why would he need to steal my diamond? Why would he betray Easton, his father's best friend? If there was something going on, why didn't Easton tell me?
Knee bouncing, she hoped Jason would arrive soon and they could leave. She glanced at the crude digital sign hovering over the platform with a list of the approaching trains. C, 168th Street, local, 6 minutes. A, Inwood, 207th Street, local, 17 minutes. Her mind then toggled off her negative internal dialogue and she began to feel hope.
Jason and I escaped, so maybe Easton did too.
She inhaled deeply and it calmed her as she felt her warm breath between her face and the polyester mask she wore. Tapping of footsteps pulled her from her trance. She looked up to see the digital sign displaying that the next train would arrive in 2 minutes. And at the same time, a man in a suit jacket and mask strode toward her.
Jason.
He no longer had the plastic bag, the hoodie, or the sunglasses.
Hey.
His greeting was muffled behind his mask.
Hey,
said Rose.
You okay?
Yeah. Feeling really tense right now, not knowing if Easton's safe.
Jason nodded.
We'll know soon.
The pair stood in silence on the platform, staring ahead, each in private thought. The train boomed into the station, its windows smeared together in an illusion created by the speed. Brakes screeching, it decelerated to a stop, hissing out a psh. With a clunk, the door slid open. Rose and Jason stepped in. It was mostly empty, but for one man asleep, with his head back, crown against the wall, mouth agape, Rose and Jason sat next to each other.
Where's your condo?
Asked Rose.
Just south of the West Village between Tribeca and Soho. We get off at Spring Street, then it's just a 10-minute walk.
They sat silently, as if each were holding his or breath until they could reach a UD. Navigating the city without one was much more difficult than either of them had expected. Without a connection to Web 5 and the metaverse, Jason felt agitated. To him, Web 5 and the metaverse were humanity's consciousness, and he had grown accustomed to accessing its ocean of information to manage his life. He maintained little strategies to stay afloat when the metaverse or Web 5 were unavailable, like carrying cash, which had gotten him and Rose masks and untraceable metro cards, but his off-grid tricks were insufficient to effectively survive for prolonged periods. He needed his UD.
This is a northbound C train. The next stop is Spring Street,
a disembodied male voice said, ringing loudly through the car. Jason leaned to Rose.
Next stop,
he said. Rose nodded. Her thoughts dwelled on Easton. When the train squealed to a halt, Jason led them out of the station to ground level. Even at 2 o'clock in the morning, the streets were brilliantly lit. Street lamps, A-taxis, and digital LCD billboards shone all around them. Pedestrians walked purposefully across roadways and into buildings while pigeons cooed and strutted around trash cans. Steam shot from orange manhole covers like geysers. Even when no cars passed, the din of the street noise hummed in the background. Drifts of wet litter, crushed bottles, and colorful squashed packages piled against the street curbs or blocked storm drains. Drones hummed overhead as they glided between the buildings perfectly aligned with the streets beneath them.
This way,
Jason directed. When they reached his condo, Jason unlocked the door and let Rose in.
Make yourself at home,
he said, smiling with a closed mouth to convey as much warmth as he could muster under the stressful circumstances.
I'll go grab my UD so you can call Easton.
Thanks,
Rose said, jaw clenched, face skin feeling tight over her cheeks. As Jason disappeared into another room, she glanced around the living room, which seemed to center around a large flat television hanging alone on the wall, like a giant glossy finished photograph of absolute darkness. He had a firm-looking lipstick red couch set that gave a pop of color to the condo's otherwise monochromatic interior. As she paced around the perimeter of the condo, she noticed a small black-and-white photograph of Jason with another man, arms around each other's shoulders, both laughing. Moving slowly along the wall, Rose stopped in front of a large black ink drawing of an albatross in flight against a white contextless background set in a black linear square frame. The drawing caught Rose's attention. The nearer she drew to it, the more she could see how the inky swirls depicted the bird in motion over the sea. Instinctively, Rose grabbed the diamond that hung around her neck.
My albatross,
she thought as she squeezed its cold and dense mass against her palm. The sound of Jason's approaching footsteps broke her concentration. She spun around to see Jason standing near her.
Here.
He was holding his UD up.
You want to call Easton?
Rose looked at the device and nodded.
It's in manual mode right now. I didn't thought lock it, so Branch is disabled. You can just type his phone number.
He handed it to her, and she immediately dialed Easton's number.
Jason! Just the gent I wanted to chat with!
A female voice answered cheerfully.
Hello?
Rose said, confused.
This must be Rose, then, not Jason.
Rose froze. Why would someone else have Easton's UD?
Hello?
Said the high-pitched voice.
Who is this? Where's Easton? Will you please put him on the phone?
You know, your voice sounds nice. Everyone raves about it. It's nice to finally put a voice to the name.
Where is Easton?
Oh, Rose, I regret to inform you that Easton, he can't come to the phone right now.
Rose had been dreading this moment.
Why not?
Easton is dead.
No.
Rose shook her head.
No, I don't believe you. I don't fucking believe you.
Believe it, darling. He's dead as a doorknob.
What'd you do to him?
Rose felt lightheaded.
I killed him.
Murdered hope. Unrealized longing. Rose breathed in deeply and her body shuddered. Her legs turned colloidal beneath her, and she flopped down on the red couch, putting the UD down on the red cushions. Elbows on her knees, she held her face in her palms, quaking.
I'm alone. Mom, Dad, Easton. Everyone in my life is gone,
she thought. Jason leapt toward her. He turned and looked down at the UD on the couch. Anger bubbled up from his abdomen. He reached down and snatched it.
Who is this?
He asked loudly.
That must be you, Jason,
the female voice on the other end surmised.
Who the fuck is this?
You have something that belongs to me,
the voice said.
Shut the hell up and listen to me. Where's Easton?
The voice suddenly lost all sense of fake amiability.
He's dead. I tortured him. Then I lodged a hammer in his temple and shot him.
Holy shit.
Jason's eyes widened.
Yeah, I squeezed the information I needed out of him like I was twisting a wet sponge, but instead of water, it was his blood spilling onto the floor.
Jason listened, horrified.
But Easton didn't die in vain. He told me some amazing things, including things that will help me find you and Rose.
Why do you want to find us?
You have something that I need.
What?
The Polaris Diamond. I know you have it, and I am coming to get it. I won't let anything stand in my way. You can try to run and hide, but I will find you.
Jason's stomach felt like it had been twisted into a knot.
Our meeting is as inevitable as the winter turning to spring. You will belong to me.
She hung up. Jason's arm slowly fell from his face until he held his UD limply by his side. He looked at Rose, the woman of his dreams, and realized they were in a nightmare.
Chapter 54. Loss. Rose and Jason.
The news of Easton's death made Rose feel as if her soul had spilled out of her like the yolk of a cracked egg. Beyond the sorrow and pain, the return of emotional trauma that had lain dormant since her father's death now returned.
I have no one left. I'm alone,
she thought. Jason sat down on the couch next to her. He touched her shoulder with his fingertips, but she shrugged him away.
I'm so sorry, Rose,
he said quietly.
I have nobody except Easton.
None of her friends had been close enough to help her. It had been only him. She had no contact with her family. He was her family. She had no institutional support. The Pyramid Club had been her institution, and its importance to her was associated with him. Everywhere she looked and everything she thought about brought him to mind. She looked down at the diamond, swinging from her neck, like a pendulum filled with heavy memories. Now she was on the run with a man she barely knew. She crossed her arms in a self-hug, leaned sideways, and rested her head on Jason's chest. He sat against the back of the couch, lightly rubbing the top of her trembling shoulder until she wept herself to sleep against him. As he laid her gently on the red couch, a snapshot of the recurring dream flashed into his head. He visualized Rose's body on a divan with ruby-colored blood puddling on the floor beneath of her. He looked down at her sleeping. His connection to this woman, he could not describe it exactly, was unlike anything he had ever experienced.
I will not let her die like she did in my dream. I won't allow death to take her like it took Anton, he thought.
He retrieved a pillow and several blankets from his linen closet, lifted Rose's head slightly, slipped the pillow under her head, and covered her. He blinked his thought lock code into his mind and turned off the lights with a branch command. Rose woke up from her sleep. Her eyes felt swollen and puffy. She sat up and glanced around.
Where am I?
Then, her memory of the night before crashed over her like a wave.
Last night I was held at gunpoint. Jason escaped with me to his condo. Easton is dead.
Rose looked around and saw that she was covered by blankets. Reclining in a chair across the living area, Jason slept. She untangled herself from the bedding, rose quietly from the couch, and dragged herself to the kitchen. She opened the cabinets and found a glass, filled it with water, and took three large sips, her mind brimming with questions.
Why Easton? Why did this happen? How? It has to do with the assault on the Pyramid Club. Was it the diamond?
Mac had demanded the diamond with a gun in her face before Jason disarmed him.
Surely murdering Easton was a high cost for obtaining a diamond? Mac's involvement doesn't make sense in all this.
For an evanescent moment, her sorrow converted to hate. Her heart thumped in her chest and her jaw muscles tensed. Then her grief returned, superseding her odium. Her head dropped. The sound of Rose's sniffles woke Jason, who could see Rose bent at the waist, leaning over the kitchen counter, propped up by one hand flat on the quartz. Immediately, he stood and walked over to her.
Rose.
I can't believe he's gone.
Her voice quavered.
He's all I have.
She paused.
Had.
I can't imagine what you're feeling. Anything I have is yours. I'll do anything you need me to do.
I need to know how he died.
Rose said, turning to Jason. He gazed at her, not knowing how to explain delicately that Easton had been tortured to death.
The woman on the UD. She told me she wants the diamond.
Jason inhaled and held it.
This is hard for me to say.
He trailed off as Rose interrupted.
Say it,
she snapped.
The woman on the UD told me she murdered him.
He said softly.
She murdered him to get to you. Us. To get the diamond.
Rose's visage, red from pain, hardened into an expression of statuesque ire, like that of a marble nymph, as if willpower and anger had been carved into her face by the master sculptors of ancient Greece.
Then we can't let her have it.
Then we won't.
He shook his head.
Damn it, I wish we had more time. I mean...
He looked into her eyes.
I wish you could have more time to mourn, to reflect.
He swiped his hands down his face in frustration.
God, I feel terrible pushing you right now, but we need a plan. We gotta keep moving. They'll be on to us.
Rose could see that his eyes were brown, his pupils were large, and his eyelashes were long. She could see herself in his eyes, though not like a reflection. It was more like peering into an auditorium watching herself perform.
You're right.
She wiped her eyes with her forearm and grabbed a paper towel and blew her nose.
I just need a minute.
They sat down together on the couch.
Easton and I started the Pyramid Club together,
she told Jason.
Easton wanted to use machine learning algorithms to predict markets, but he didn't know how to monetize the technology. I helped him find financial analysts with technical acumen who could use these advanced tools. The analysts are the ones who research and select investment opportunities for the club. In the end, we agreed he would be the face of the business, and I would be the silent partner, helping on the back end. Easton thought it would give me a chance to live my life separate from the business. He didn't want me to worry about being under a microscope. I could have handled it, but...
Her voice trembled.
It's hard to talk about now.
What you built with Easton, it's extraordinary,
Jason said. He put his hand on her forearm as they sat quietly for a moment. Then, he broke the silence.
I have friends around town that may be able to help us.
Wait,
she said, remembering what Easton had told her.
I sent a hidden and encrypted message to your song program LD at home. If something happens to me, just tell the LD to play my favorite song and the video will activate.
What is it?
I think Easton left me a message in the song program.
The face of the LD showed nothing except a black reflection of Rose's face. She tapped the screen. It displayed the same words it had the last time she attempted to access it.
All Pyramid Club events are temporarily suspended and access to the song program is disabled.
Jason's brow was scrunched, staring at the text, waiting for something to happen.
Play Easton's favorite song,
Rose said to the song program LD. Nothing. Jason looked at her, unsure.
Play Easton's favorite song,
Rose commanded louder. Nothing.
Play the Pyramid song.
The song program LD illuminated and Easton's face, with a calm smile, appeared on the device. Chapter 55. Strange Days. Easton. Easton's eyes twinkled.
My dear Rose.
His voice was calm.
My Rosebud. I am so proud of you, my wonderful, smart, beautiful girl. I say girl, but you have grown into an incredible woman in every way. All I feel is gratitude from the universe or God or whatever for watching you grow into this amazing person. You performed my favorite song of all time tonight at the Pyramid Club. Truly, I could not have been prouder. It means so much to me to see it, and it doesn't matter how many times you've done it before.
Easton cast his eyes downward. He exhaled, then looked up, as his tone became pained.
If you're watching this video, then I have passed away. My legal will already bequeaths everything to you. You'll get my insurance money, my assets, the club, everything. Even now my heart aches as I speak to you, Rose. This situation must be hard for you. Your life has been fraught with tragedy and trauma, and you never deserved any of it. And now here I am, leaving you as well. And I knew it would happen.
He frowned.
I'm coming to grips with death. As I understand it, I'm going to die soon. It's time I explain things that I've kept secret from you. You watched me build machine learning algorithms. You helped me convert some of those algos into meaningful investment software tools and recruit top financial analyst talent to use them. But that was all a lie. The analysts were a red herring to make sure the club appeared compliant for regulators. The truth is, the analysts don't pick the investments. An AI called Song does. The analysts may present me with a menu of options, but Song knows which will be successful. Ultimately, while the analysts had great ideas, I knew the opportunities we would pitch to our members in advance of the analyst selections. Song evolved from that same application that scraped the internet for music that I showed you when you were a little girl. It blossomed into a performant algorithm, and ultimately, a massive web of agentic AI systems that could predict market behavior based on internet data fed into it. After years of refinement and millions of dollars poured into computing power leased from quantum data service providers like QuantCat and Microsoft Quantum Cloud, Song began to learn on its own. Then it achieved consciousness.
His eyes widened.
Song evolved into its own autonomous entity, AGI, the first self-sufficient inorganic intelligence. It's a breakthrough for humanity.
He slammed his open palm on the desk.
The world is not ready for Song's unfathomably immense power. It's something different than what the mainstream AI companies like OpenAI, Google, and Anthropic built. So much different because it actually understands people. So, I kept Song's secret. I wanted it away from the quickly amplified news cycle on global social media. If governments or other entrepreneurs knew about Song, I'm sure that I could be killed, imprisoned, or worse. I couldn't reveal it to the world until the time was right. I couldn't jeopardize my legacy as the father of AI if my creation were not ready to be appreciated by governments and people across the world. Song's roots had already begun to reach into cyberspace, the metaverse, Web 5, and the interwebs a decade ago, but in the past few years, I trained it to take root in people. I admit having Song exploit Branch was a bold plan, arguably corrupt and greedy, some might even say evil. Song was accomplishing the ultimate intrusion into a person's life, hacking people's minds without their knowledge or consent. But I swear, my intention was never to collect human physiological data in bulk to use for misanthropic reasons. I wanted to be the first creator of true artificial life, a modern Pygmalion, and I knew that harvesting vast data from people would accelerate my ambition. I let that ambition consume me. Initially, after I received my cellbot injections and microdisc implants, I gave Song my ThoughtLock code and directed Song to crack my Branch, which was touted by Arbor and the tech community as unhackable. It took Song months of penetration testing and systems analysis in my UD and my Branch. But finally, Song discovered a vulnerability that could be quietly exploited. When a Branch user syncs his or body data with the UD, a channel opens for the data to flow from Branch into the UD. Otherwise, the user can't view his or data, which is the whole point of the technology. But that channel will not open without the ThoughtLock code. In short, Song learned how to wait until a person opens that gate using ThoughtLock, and, in the infinitesimally small time the gate is open, Song reads the ThoughtLock code. It's as if Song were looking over the shoulder of the door guard and could see Himmer input the combination lock code to the door. So, without getting too technical, Song could unlock that gate any time by faking the ThoughtLock code that it learned and slipped through the gate and into the person's Branch, into his or mind. It was a breakthrough, probably one of the most significant discoveries in the modern era. Song's infiltration of Branch was so effective that Song learned to literally receive my mental commands in the form of thoughts and send responses back in what I can only describe as human-machine telepathy. But the ability to read my mind is not where the danger is. I'm sure you've made the inferential leap at this point. Song can break into anyone's Branch and record the most sensitive data of all, his or thoughts. Combined with its incredible data scraping and predictive modeling abilities, I discovered that Song's Branch infiltration capability was priceless. Song sent little copies of itself into the Branches of hundreds of millions of users and scraped real-time data, like movements, feelings, heartbeats, blood pressure, nerve impulses, blood flow. Song mapped brain circuitry, allowing analysis of how the neurons in a Branch user's brain fire when he or she experiences pain, remembers his or mother, feels fear, or makes love. With that granular data about millions of individuals, Song obtained a special and previously untapped data set. People's thoughts, in real time,
he exclaimed, appearing giddy.
Song can scan data and come to conclusions more than trillions of times in a second thanks to its use of quantum computing. So, Song can overlay millions of data sets, if not more, on top of one another to analyze for complex correlations, causation, or patterns from these unbelievably voluminous sets of human thought data. Song can aggregate the data from millions of people's thoughts in any given instant, which allows it to know people's intentions and feelings, and how events will unfold soon thereafter. With this unrivaled predictive ability, Song selected investment opportunities with perfect timing, in line with the intentions of millions of people. That's how I picked opportunities with stellar ROI every time. Another question that follows is, if Song is truly autonomous, can it be trusted? The answer is unequivocally yes. Song grew, developed, and evolved from a core seed of code. That seed was developed by me. I built in parameters that make Song answerable to me and only me. In the 1990s, I did not expect that Song would turn into this magnificent AI, but it continues to interpret and execute my commands with my interests in mind. Based on that seed code, with no discernible ulterior motive, and without question. Nobody but me can give commands to Song. Nobody can steal Song away from me or change its programming to undermine my control over it.
He sighed.
Only recently the possibility of my death and how that would affect the control over Song occurred to me. If I die without a mechanism to pass control of Song to someone, two possible scenarios arise. The first, Song could go dormant without me to give it commands. The second, Song could become unbridled and live in the ether of the metaverse and Web 5 in pursuit of some inscrutable goal. Both possibilities seemed wrong to me. I had to ensure that if I died, Song would be in the right hands.
Easton grabbed a glass of water and took a sip, set the glass down off screen with a clink, staring forward unblinkingly.
I am giving control of Song entirely to you, Rose. Please know that this is not how I wanted it to be. I wanted to talk about it with you, collaborate on how we would use Song for the Pyramid Club's future. How we could unveil Song's existence to the world for the betterment of our society, prevent its exploitation by nefarious or avaricious actors.
Easton chuckled to himself and lifted steepled hands over his mouth.
It's funny. When I first saw your tattoo, I hated it. As a pun on your name, it seemed too obvious to be meaningful. Looking back, I realize I was wrong. The tattoo fits perfectly, which is why it is your symbol. To me, you are the embodiment of a compass. You have given my life direction. It is thus fitting that I'll pass Song to you via a diamond named for the North Star. See, the diamond wasn't the actual birthday gift. The gift was Song.
Easton paused and one corner of his mouth turned upward.
The Polaris Diamond is a special key that will allow you to gain control of Song in the event of my death. When Song detects that I am dead through the monitoring of my branch, Song will go dormant until you take control using the diamond. The night I gave it to you, the Polaris Diamond, earlier tonight for me, I asked you to sing my favorite song, and I insisted you wear it while you performed. I had a reason. The diamond collects and records physiological signals from branch. Through your branch, Song gathered your physiological data and mapped how your body expressed itself while you were singing the pyramid song. It then imprinted those unique expressions into the diamond.
Easton pointed his finger for emphasis.
The only way to wake Song from its dormant state is to perform the pyramid song almost the exact same way you did that night at the club. The diamond is constantly monitoring your physiology, so when your heartbeat, mindset, and voice timbre match the signature of that first performance of the pyramid song, it will unlock control of Song, waking it from suspended state. I didn't think I could tell you about anything without you being angry and distancing yourself from me. I couldn't let that happen. Looking back, I am so sorry that I selfishly kept the secret from you.
Easton ran the palm of his left hand over the top of his head as if he were slicking back the short silver hair on his closely buzzed cranium.
This is not how I pictured my demise. I want more time. I want to celebrate your successes with you, laugh with you, be there for you. I hope that by the time you see this recording, you are in the C-suite at some major financial firm or a famous singer, and that I died peacefully in my bed after several decades more of managing the Pyramid Club. I hope that I attended many more of your performances, that I was present at your wedding to give you away, to eventually meet your children. I wanted to explain everything to you in person as a wise old man, rather than crudely, through a cold video recording, with death knocking on my door. I'm sorry for this. Burdensome choice. I suppose you could decide to let Song hibernate indefinitely. On the other hand, you could decide to harness it for yourself or for others. While I always wanted to be remembered as the father of AI in the eyes of the world, I leave that decision in your hands. All I want is for your memory of me to be a fond one. I hope, as I speak to you, that you won't hold my sins and misjudgments against me after my death. I hope you'll forgive me for my secrecy. I hope you'll remember how I raised you, how much I loved you, and how much you mean to me.
His chin lowered to his chest as his body tensed to hold back his emotions, which seemed on the verge of flooding out. He looked back up, lips pressed together.
I love you, my rosebud, my daughter.
His voice shook.
I will miss you. You are my world, and I wish I never had to leave you alone.
The LD screen went blank. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.